Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, Miss Ann. And we're still in Peter's native land, but only for part of a program this week, because we ran out, but we've got an exciting track to finish up with anyway, a snack that you just must know about. So hang with us to the end of the program. And this program's sort of like old home week, because one of our meetings again with someone that we met several years ago was totally out of the blue, quite unexpected. That's our first interview. And that was terrific fun. And then we went back to see our friends Tina and Tony Bricknell Webb at Percy's and found out not only that they're going from strength to strength, but also Tina's just produced a cookbook, so she's going to talk to us about those things. And then a really great new snack food, which, you know, calling it a cracker just doesn't really create
See,
the right
I love that too. This is like a program to warm my heart. Yeah, I love it.
So anyway, we're going to start up with a Italian turned Brit called Vito Scaduto, who was the general manager at the Bath Priory where we reported 2 weeks ago with Sue Williams. Vito worked for Sue. And then he and his brother decided that they wanted to go off on their own and create a restaurant venture, and they have. And it was just a wonderful surprise to see Vito again. A wonderful interview.
Smart place, beautiful place.
And a great place to go.
Talk about serendipity. Peter was just leafing through a magazine in our last hotel room, which was the city magazine for the Bath, and found an old friend. We were so excited about it. We called, and then we came here for lunch. And here we have now, at Red or White is the name of the restaurant. It's called Red or White, but Vito Scaduto, who has this wonderful degree, he'll explain to us later, MCA as proprietor. We haven't seen him since he was at Bath Priory, and we loved him then, and we love his restaurant, his new restaurant now. Vito, I mean, you may not think it's so serendipitous, but we had this fabulous lunch, and we are so excited to see you again. Would you bring us up to date on, first of all, how long have you been here? What's happened in your life? You used to be at Bath Priory.
Yes, again, you know, it was a pleasure to hear you this morning when you rang me. And again, a pleasure to see you again. You know, it's nice to see people which are now new visit me in the past in Bath. And hopefully they came to me now in Trowbridge. And we've been here, we took over the restaurant about 9 months ago, myself and my brother. And we did a big, you know, big refurbishment into the restaurant, bring it back to date. It's a little bit of decor, it's modern. And also it's got lots of lovely corners. And we use every corners from the restaurant, in the restaurant, basically.
Now you slid over this. Tell our listeners exactly where Trowbridge is. And I want to add, by the way, the place is stunning.
Trowbridge, basically, it's a county town in Wiltshire, and it's only 15 minutes drive from Bath, and about 5 minutes drive from Bradford-on-Avon, which, and again, is a destination, a nice historic town in Wiltshire. There is, we say, Trowbridge is just coming up, and it's been going through changes in the town. It was very industrial, and now with the falling of the industry, it's starting to develop on the other side. And as a restaurant, there's not many restaurants in this area, unfortunately. And hopefully we're trying to, you know, try to do our best to bring a culinary to this town and this county.
Now, I keep remarking about how wonderful the decor, the ambience of this restaurant is. You bought essentially a wine shop, and then you knocked all the walls down. It's decidedly a contemporary space. Tell us a little bit about the different areas in it.
Basically, the area, as you say, when we took over, it was a wine shop with a little bistro. And so we knocked a few walls down, and, you know, hopefully the building didn't fall down on us. So, and what have we done? We developed into, the idea is to develop like an Italian enoteca, which I knew you got a wine shop, a little bit of delicatessen, and then a restaurant and bar. So people that can come in, have a look at the wines, and buy a bottle to take away, or buy a bottle to drink at the table. And also, you know, when they eat in the restaurant, enjoying the food, then they can buy some of the produce, the things like some Italian pasta, some marmalades, you know, from Sicily, olive oil. We go to this wonderful planet, olive oil from Sicily, and a few other products.
Well, listeners, as you know, my background is Sicilian, so I'm, like, totally enamored of this place. The chef, is he Sicilian as well?
No, the chef is English, but he's got a lot, you know, he's traveled around Italy, so he likes Italian food. He likes the style of cooking him is simple, but with good flavor.
His name?
Mark Salmon.
He's doing a fabulous job. What did we eat today? Let's talk a little bit about that.
And I think you had a...
The carpaccio.
The carpaccio, beef carpaccio, which one is a local fillet of beef, very thinly sliced, and we serve that with some pickled beetroots, which one has got the red, white, and yellow beetroot, and a little bit of reddish, and then a light little bit of rucola and Parmesan cheese, and finish off with hazelnut dressing.
Which brings us to the issue of the fact that you have Sicilian influences in your kitchen, but you use really premium local products, don't you?
Yes, yeah, we're trying to use, again, as we say, we use local produce, things like the beef that's reared about 10 miles from here, the beetroot, the vegetables, they're grown locally, but we, as we say, using local produce, but married with Italian tradition.
Now, what else? We have this, the sausage that took me back to my childhood.
And again, we got an Italian sausage, which is made with 55% pork mince, and then veal, and the rest is veal with a little bit of fennel seed and a touch of chili, which on the sausage is all meat. And we make the mixer, which on the butchers do for ourselves. And we did the recipe about 9 months ago. We tried different recipe, and I think that's the one which on it worked best. And it's also, it means not too fine, but not too coarse. So it gives it really lovely flavor, and again, from Italy, especially from Sicily.
But, you know, you make it accessible to your English audience because you really served it with mashed potatoes, which is banger and mash.
That's right, yeah. So as you say, it's a banger and mash with a twist. You know, we just got the Italian sausage, the mash, which is classical English, and then we finish off with the sauce, which has got, again, a strong and married of English. Is like the sauce, it was like a gravy, but with some cherry tomato and basil. So just bring about, you know, bring it the flavor.
I had this mackerel, which was wonderful. Where do you source your seafood?
The seafood is sourced from the coast of Como. Mackerel, which you find a lot on like on English Riviera on the coast. It's a fish which, and again, it's used in the Mediterranean, in the scombro. And the way we cook is just baked in the oven with some breadcrumbs, herb breadcrumbs. And then it's got some vegetables, beetroot, some salads, and finish off with the sour cream.
Now, Sicilians love dessert, and you have some fairly elaborate desserts. You want to mention a few of them?
Of course, yes. We've got a Sicilian lemon tart, which is a classical lemon tart. It's made with Sicilian lemon, and then finish off with a mandarine sorbet, which is a sorbet made with mandarin and a mandarin liqueur, which is produced by a producer in Sicily. So full of flavor, quite fresh, which gives a nice contrast. Another sweet, which we do, it's a roasted peach, a peach which has been roasted, a little bit of sugar, and then served on with a little bit of polenta cake with some pistachio ice cream. And again, a pistachio, which we use, it's pistachio which grown in Etna, in the mountain Etna, which the best you can find in the market.
And this, you have wine stored everywhere, all over this place. It's part of the decor, but it's also part of a very important program. Talk to us a little bit about your wine program.
It's on the wines, again, because as the name it mentions, red or white, and that's referring to the wines. And we got a very extensive wine list, and also an extended wine storage, which is part of the deco. And we're trying to have a very wide extension of wines from Italy, but also married with a few others, a little bit of French, Chilean, California, German, Spanish wines. But again, very strong on the Italian. And basically the idea on the wines is that we got wines which are very affordable. We got wines which we started from £12.50 a bottle, and then going up to the Sassicaia, the Solaia, But still at a good price. We've got a Sassicaia, which I need, one of the vintage 98, at £115, which I need in this day and age, it's a bargain. And then a few other, we got some very good Hermitage, very good from Dallas, and again at £38. And the idea is that people that can have a good meal with a good bottle of wine.
We've known that you are a really very, very experienced professional. But one of the best signs of it is you're making this wonderful, really exciting experience so affordable. Your prices are very reasonable. How do you do that? Well, let's mention what some of the prices are.
We're doing on the lunchtime. We're doing a one course lunch, which has got like a pasta, which is £5.95. We're doing that's in pounds, yes. And then on the main courses, we've got the sausage, which is £6.75, and the three courses £13.50. I think in a 2 days market, you need to be competitive. You need to understand also what we are. We are in the town, which is a working town, and then lunch is very difficult to get people out for lunch nowadays and with the recession. But again, if we use simple, good produce, it's not expensive. It's not, the sausage, we make ourselves, and with a little bit of mush and tomato, it doesn't, we're trying to stay into the coast.
One of the challenges of the beautiful Victorian city of the wonderful Regency city of Bath is that you can visit there, but you can't find a place to park. And it may be that one of the closest places you can park where there's a restaurant just happens to be called Red or White. So don't forget that. If you're looking to explore this area, this is just a great place to stop either before or after you did that.
Well, I'm just reeling from the fact that we just found you again and that it was such a wonderful experience. How will other people find you? Do you have a website or an address or a...
Yes, we do have a website, the website is www.redorwhite.biz, B-I-Z. And then also people they find it because of my connection with Bath, my old customer, and also through, obviously, to the address. And following up with what Peter has said, we are in, I think the spot where we are is a great spot, we are not too far from Bath. We are on the way, to Stonehenge. If you go off the 836, we only 5 minutes. And usually if you go to Stonehenge, there's not any many restaurants over there. So on the way back, it's perfect. Again, very near to Laycock, where you've been this morning. So it's only 15, 20 minutes away from there. So it's a great stop. We're right in the middle. And as I say, easy parking. We've got plenty of parking in the space, in the back of the restaurant, which I need. You can park your car and have a good lunch or dinner.
Grazie mille. We have such a good time. It was a really wonderful break in our trip, and the sun shining.
So, again, it's been a pleasure to see you, and hopefully we'll see you back again.
Will do. Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. This is the part of the program where we ask you to connect with us and communicate with us via those little buttons on our website, Facebook, Twitter,
blog,
email. That's old-fashioned anymore, it seems to me.
And all you have to do is push the right button and away you go.
Hey, did I tell you about the funny discovery I made today with my computer?
No, you didn't.
I went to do that emoticon for the smiley face with the colon and the parenthesis.
Yes.
My computer program changes it into a smiley face.
Isn't that remarkable?
I'm still trying to find out how to get the musical notes.
Yeah, I don't know how to fix that. But I do know that we always have a smile on our face when we visit old friends that we really
That's
like.
That's a cool transition.
Oh, that was such a brilliant transition.
Tony and Tina, they're great.
The only disadvantage of this place, and it's an advantage once you get there, is this really is a hole-in-the-wall little town. That the town of Virginstowe, I swear, doesn't even really exist. And as we were approaching...
I mean, the place is not a hole in the wall. The place is really elegant wonderful.
But finding it's pretty tough, and especially when the road across Roadford Lake, which is the direct way there, is closed to traffic, which we found. But Miss Garman did a wonderful job.
Yeah, Garman worked.
Navigating us all the way there, and we had a wonderful visit with Tony and Tina, and when you hear their interviews, you'll know why. First up, an interview with both Tony and Tina talking about how Persis has changed since the last time we were there and the other things they're up to. And then a project that Tina's been working on for a long time, her very own cookbook. So we'll put both of these together in the same segment. It's a long segment, but I'm sure you'll find it fascinating.
On the menu is at Heaven in Devon. We're talking to Tina and Tony Bricknell Webb, who are owners. And I should mention that that's called Chef Tina first. But also, we're at the property, and I think we're going to have, it's called Percy's Country House and Restaurant, and I always call it a working organic farm as well. Welcome to On the Menu, you two. We always go back to places that we love, and of course, this is our second trip here, so you know we love this place. Tony, tell us a little bit about exactly where it is, because it's pretty far away from the chaos, which is why it's called an oasis in Devon, the chaos of this part of the United Kingdom.
West Devon, 4 miles east of the Cornish border, so we're a long way down. Essentially, we're in the middle of Devon and Cornwall, so quite a nice place to come to go out to various parts of the southwest. We're in a very rural setting. Very rural indeed.
Yes, I would say it's very rural. But our Garmin found us, found you. I mean, we had our positioning device just firmly leading us.
We do have mains water and we do have electricity, so that's a plus.
That's
and
a whole other thing.
Everybody has their own toilet.
Oh, listen, we'll talk about that in a little bit. This is a luxury accommodation, listeners. Anyhow, go ahead. Virgin Stone.
One of the most striking features I always think about this place is the sky at night. Absolutely zero light pollution. And when we have our normal clear skies, you look up at night and the stars are absolutely amazing. Cities and light pollution, we don't have this here. Very noisy place. The birds make a lot of noise in the morning.
Yeah, the birds, I've heard. They're nests all over the place.
And I've got to warn you about the 5:30 crow that comes along and taps on the window at 5:30 on your room. But that's the joys of living in the country.
That's great. Now, how did you get here, Tina? I mean, you're a city person.
No, I wouldn't say I was a city person.
No,
but
I thought you were.
I was a country bumpkin when I was a kid.
Oh,
and
okay.
And then I sort of trundled into opening a wine bar and restaurant in town. And so we lived above that on a main road with lots of traffic. And coming down to Devon was basically getting back to my roots, which was being in the country and having some great relationships with animals and what have you. So
you're really good with the animals. I mean, what kinds do you have?
They're very good with me. They haven't killed me yet. So no, we have Pedigree Organic large black pigs. We have a large flock of probably 200 strong sheep, which are Jacob, Suffolk and Blue Texel crosses. And we obviously use the meat in the restaurant, but we also utilize the wool and have that spun and then knitted into jumpers.
Tina's very embarrassed, but she's won a lot of awards. And one of the awards she's won is for her meat, for her lamb. She won Best Lamb for Devon and also Best Organic Product for the Southwest, which was also her lamb. And quite proud of that because obviously we came out of the suburbs of London knowing nothing about farming in 96. And we beat all the Devon farmers, so there you go.
Now, this place was a wreck, essentially, because I've seen the photo album.
Yeah, that's right. And I can always remember just after we bought it, Tina's grandmother came over from the States. Her grandfather was dropped her off as he was going off to Sicily to pay homage to Lipari, where he came from. Uh-huh. And we were up in London with the restaurant and we used to come down here every weekend. And so grandmother was dumped on us, so we brought her down. And I can always remember very proudly stopped the car at the top of the drive and turned around to grandma and said, you know, grandma, some parts of this building are over 500 years old. And there was this silence and look of horror on her face, and her Upper New York steak accent came into play, and she turned round to her favourite granddaughter and said, "What? Can't this guy afford a new one?"
Very good.
Yeah, she then got stuck in the bath, and we had to get a local farmer to help haul her out.
But she enjoyed that. She enjoyed
that.
This
is one of, like, endless adventures you've had since you started this. Why don't you just run through? I know that we did this once before, but the philosophy that drove you here.
Well, it was essentially that we found that when we started to grow a little bit of our own produce, just how much better received it was from customers, and how much better the flavour was and the whole dining experience. It spurred us on to venture then into breeding our own meat for the table and going into soft fruit and orchards. And so the whole thing has been an evolvement. And now when we go out to eat, perhaps at other restaurants, even some very well acclaimed restaurants, we can taste the difference in the integrity of the ingredients, because we're very jealous of our ability to step outside the kitchen and to harvest an entire meal just a couple of hours before. Obviously, we can't harvest the meat a couple of hours before, but that's nicely hung and got to the right condition before it comes into the kitchen. But to be able to pick herbs and salad leaves and fruit and everything for a particular group of people on any one day, the flavours are just amazing. And it spoils you, actually.
I know. I'm spoiled myself, actually. But tell us about your curing and your ham and bacon production and sausages and all the other products.
Well, again, this was we decided that we couldn't. We tried a number of different brands of organic bacon a few years ago, and we weren't entirely enthralled with the products that we had sourced. And we were into breeding horses at the time, and we had one that we called Lady Chef. She was a chestnut thoroughbred, and she was racing at Lingfield. In the summer, I think it was July 2003. And she won her race, and she had some winnings to come after that race. And Tony then decided that he'd buy me two sows in pig, which he did. And so we duly watched them farrow and their progeny grow up. And then when the time came, we had some slaughtered, and I hired a man, enlisted or enrolled the help of a gentleman called Maynard Davies, who has worked in the States in his time.
Yeah, he's very well known, right?
Is he?
Isn't he? I mean, he's written books on...
Yes, he has written books. He's called... Yeah, his first one was called The Bacon Curer. Okay. His second book was called The Adventures of a Bacon Curer. Anyway, he came down to Percy's, and he spent a couple of days with me, and he taught me all about curing. And we've been on the phone nearly every week ever since. And so he set me well on my way to curing and to creating my own hams and different cures and what have you.
And they're yummy. And tell for listeners in the UK, tell them about your website and that the products are going to be available.
Yes, the website is www.percys.co.uk, and we're soon going to set up an e-commerce site for the pork and lamb products and a few other bits and pieces. We shall be supplying recipes with different cuts of meat to show people how they can recreate some of the recipes in the book and get the very best out of the meat that they purchase from us.
And ship preserves anywhere, can't you?
Probably.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to make preserves. What we shall do, what I shall do is encourage people to, obviously, if I were to have to communicate with you in the US, I'd say go out and get some produce, or say, for example, pumpkin chutney.
Wow.
That's good. That's really that big. Good. It's one of my favorite preserves. It really is. It's fantastic. I'd say get your pumpkins or your squashes when they're really nice and vibrant orange and really quite dark. The darker the color, the riper the fruit. And give it a good tap when it's nice and hollow. And the stem is dry, then it's ready for harvesting. And then follow the recipe. I'm not sure which page it's on, but I tell you, this pumpkin chutney is so easy to make. It keeps beautifully, and it goes with, things like goat's cheese and pork and a number of different things. The other preserve I would encourage you to make is not the rhubarb. It's called the beetroot and ginger chutney, which also is quite good with the cold meats, either smoked or unsmoked, like the hams, etc.
Now, Tony just came back from rushing away to answer the telephone, because this is a very hands-on operation here. When you come here, you'll find out. But two things are in his particular area that I want to encourage him to talk about. One is the seafood program. Clearly, you don't have your own lake or your own ocean, so you did something about that was really quite unusual.
Well, we had difficulty in getting fish, and we used to get it from Lou through a trader. And the fish from Lou is very, very good because it's day boats. So they go out, come back, whereas the beamers, they're trawlers that go out for 7 days. The fish isn't as fresh as... the fish was great, but the trouble with this particular character was every now and again he would go out and get drunk. And he used to get very, very drunk, and so we didn't get our fish. And that wasn't any good to my customers. So I decided that I would go and get a license as a trader, buy on the market at Lou. So that's what I do. I get up at 4:30 in the morning because I'm getting towards 60 these days, and... as you get older, you get up and can't go straight out. You have a potter, make a cup of tea and a shuffle around. And then I get in the car at 5:30 and get to Lou at 6:30. And where I look and see what fish is about. Tina doesn't give me a list. I just actually go down there and see what's good. And I buy it and bring a trailer load of fish back, show it to my beloved wife, and then it comes out in the evening. And when I go to market... everybody has fish in the evening.
And I think there are some day boat scallops that are on our menu for this evening, which we're really looking forward to.
I got
to.
You some diver caught scallops because of sustainability. Well, the dredgers, they dredge for scallops and they tear up the seabed. So to do my bit for sustainability, we only use diver caught scallops.
Now, there's another part, of course, of any dining program, which is the wine program. And I read a quote from somebody. You had said something to somebody that you have a Percy's and you have a restaurant in order to support your wine habit. Tell us a little bit more about that.
What, my wine habit or the person who said that?
No, just, I mean, what is it that people can expect in the wine department? You did own a wine bar before, and you're very serious about wines. We know that.
Well, we like to drink wines. Our list is, I suppose, made up of our taste. You know, our hotel is what we want when we go out. Our food is what we want when we go out. The yardstick is what we want. That's our standard. If you like what we want, you'll like here. If you don't, obviously, you won't like here.
But it's all good quality.
But the wine,
we wouldn't settle for anything less.
But the wine, again, we run a short list. It's reasonably priced. I believe that you ought to be able to get some great wines for reasonable prices and not have to pay stupid money for them. They all are selected carefully to go with our foods. I like drinking red wine with fish, so we have some nice light red wine. I believe you know, there's no mystique in wine. You have what you like to drink. You don't have to be straitjacketed by formality.
You know, we're talking around the what I think is fairly basic. Tell us about the accommodations. I mean, what actually, if somebody comes here, first of all, I guess you have to tell us how you go about arranging to reserve here. If somebody comes here, what will the experience be?
Fantastic.
I can attest to that, but let's do some details.
It's a rural aspect. So if you want to come to some peace and quiet, if you want fantastic food. Mission statement. They talk about mission statements these days, don't they? What is our mission statement? Our mission statement is to give you a wonderful meal and for you to feel normal the next day.
And have a great night's sleep. So
perhaps you don't wake up in the middle of the night with a raging thirst because the food is oversalted. You don't wake up next day feeling 1 degree under, no matter how much you enjoyed the meal the night before, because you've had a balance of foods which you don't, fats which you don't normally have.
What about the rooms?
Well, we set a lot of store. I mean, what's my stocking trade? It's apart from food.
Bums on seats and heads in beds.
Yeah, it's sitting down and lying down. You've got to get good chairs and you've got to get good beds. We have good chairs. We have good beds. Our rooms, top of the range. They have jacuzzis. They're large rooms, king-size beds.
Widescreen TVs.
Every amenity you want.
Yeah, this is not roughing it, listeners. Believe me, not roughing it at all. Yeah.
Gingerbread on arrival.
I've already had some of that, by the way.
And the dogs sit next to the Wellington boots waiting to go for a walk. So, yes, I guess our mission statement is for people to come here, have a really relaxing experience with great food, have a wonderful night's sleep.
And there are things to do, though, too.
Yeah, and be raring to go the next day.
There's some stunning views on the estate. There's lots of walking around here.
There's the coast nearby.
We have our animals. We also breed racehorses. So we have one that's could be very, very good that's about to run in the autumn. So all you guys can have a bet on it and then come over and see me. The horse is called Yes Chef.
Yes Chef. Great.
It's a horse by Lady Chef, named after my wife.
That's wonderful. Now, you were telling us about another program with your volunteer helpers. Tell us about that, because there's so much work in a place like this. I don't know how you do it at all.
We are woofing.
Woofing. I said woofing is cool.
Woofing. Worldwide opportunities on organic farms. And basically, they're volunteers from all over the world. They come and stay here. We give them accommodation and food, and it's the food that our customers eat as well. And for that, they do 40 hours a week work for us.
And they learn a skill, something they wouldn't otherwise have done. So a lot of these individuals perhaps come from a town environment where they've studied university and they're taking a gap year, and they've not seen the countryside, they've never worked with animals, or they have an interest in organic gardening, but they haven't had the opportunity to do any gardening. So it gives them an experience that they couldn't otherwise have elsewhere in a paid holiday in this situation.
And our experience with them has been really good. We've had them from Canada, Germany, America, France. We've had the odd challenging person. In fact, one's just about to leave tomorrow has been particularly challenging. He's a raw foodist vegan.
Oh, that's tough, I know.
The onion smoothies in the morning are a bit of a problem.
Yes, and nobody wants to share his home with him. So,
oh dear. Now, how does somebody volunteer for this?
Well, there's an organization called, the Woofing Organization.
It's WWOF, and if anybody wants to know more, just put that into a search engine, and you'll come up with their website. It is a worldwide organization, and if you want to become a member, I think there are different rates for different countries, but they will then give you a list of all the hosts there are globally. And you can then leaf through the book and email the different hosts as to what your requirements might be.
It looks like fun. I mean, if I were 20, I'd be here.
It is great fun. It is
great. What about your website? Can you just give us that again?
www.percys.co.uk.
We are very pleased to see that we finally have a Percy's cookbook, because we love Percy's. We're going to be talking to the author, Tina Bricknell Webb. Hello, Tina.
Hello, good afternoon.
We love Percy's. We've come twice now, and now I can make all of these wonderful dishes that you make at home, right?
That's absolutely so, yes.
If you get the kind of produce that you're used to working with, which is almost all organically grown and local on your farm.
Yes, that's right. But I'm sure that there are plenty of places in the US that where you can source equally as good quality produce.
Well, I know there are places where we can source quality produce, but I must say that what we've eaten here, your pork, your lamb, your eggs for breakfast, it's just totally extraordinary. Let's talk a little bit about people who buy this book will, and we're going to list it on our website, will find out, they're going to understand your philosophy right off the bat. The introduction by James Lovelock is just beautiful. I've read that already.
He's an amazing gentleman.
Yeah, you just went to his 90th birthday.
That's right, and something incredibly memorable, and we were very honored to have been invited.
Now, he sort of introduces this. He says that he actually was an early follower of Rachel Carson, who's her home was very near where we live, you know. And anyhow, explain, moving on to your introduction, what you set out to do here.
Well, when we first opened a restaurant in northwest London in the late 80s, we were totally dependent on cash and carries and local shops and local vegetable cash and carries to purchase anything that we were going to put on our menu. And the quality wasn't that brilliant. And shortly after opening in northwest London, we purchased what is now Percy's Country Hotel in Devon. And we set about growing our own vegetables, and then later we started rearing sheep and followed by pork and chickens, etc. And we found that the quality of the ingredients that we supplied ourselves was so much better than anything we could buy that it encouraged us to sort of spread our wings a bit and do an awful lot more. So when we decided to move down to Devon, lock, stock and barrel, we aim now to produce as much as we possibly can. So nearly everything you find on your plate, whether it be starter, main or dessert, is either grown or produced here on the Coombs Head estate.
Now, of course, we know we're dealing with pristine premium products, I should say, but let's mention that you were trained as a chef.
Yes, absolutely.
So what you do to them is why you wrote this cookbook, so other people would know what you do with them, right?
Yes. It has been a wonderful evolvement and a very fascinating learning curve. And all I can say is that it's been possible for me to teach myself how to raise animals, how to do the lambing, how to help a sow give birth to piglets, etc. And it's the most rewarding experience I think anybody can have if they're interested in that type of thing. It's also quite special to create a meal with your own ingredients. And for anybody who has the slightest bit of interest in growing your own, I would encourage you to get out there, get some seeds, get a plot of land, or even a couple of grow bags or a window box, and do whatever you can, because the pleasure it bestows on you is just enormous. It's indescribable.
Well, the photographs are just gorgeous in this cookbook, and they're very joyous, too, so you can tell you have that joy about what you're doing. One of the things that I admired about the book is that you have your tip, right, called Tina's Tips. And this one, the first one I encountered, talk to us about this, your unique method of cooking meat.
Yes, it's called pulse cooking. A lot of chefs now use a method I think they call sous vide, which is cooking in a plastic bag in water kept at a temperature of something like 60 degrees for a long period of time. I haven't adopted that in my kitchen, but what I have adopted is a method that I've dubbed or called pulse cooking. It's where you take a piece of meat or fish or chicken or what have you, and you introduce it to a reasonably high heat for a short period of time, and then you leave it to rest. And that way, the resting time allows the heat that you've introduced to the outside of the piece of meat or fish to migrate slowly towards the middle, thereby equalizing, so that when you've finished the cooking, you put it back in the oven or back under the grill slightly for a couple of minutes if it's fish. When you give it some heat and then rest it and give it some heat again and then rest it, what you're doing all the time is you're allowing the temperature to even out throughout the whole piece of food, whatever you're doing. And in the case of lamb, for example, you then, the end result is that you have something that's pink, evenly pink from top to bottom, and equally moist from the outside in, which gives the texture something really special. It really enhances the eating experience.
You know, you understand the science of all this stuff too, don't you?
Well, it's not something I studied. It's something that I started to notice. I actually stumbled on it by mistake because I'd half cook a piece of chicken and then it wouldn't go into the oven. And then I decided that I'd have to warm it through for 3 minutes or what have you. And then when I cut it through, I saw how moist it was. And I thought, well, hang on.
Uh-huh.
Let's actually experiment with other cuts of meat and indeed fish. And fish especially. A lot of the time, if you have a fillet of, say, John Dory, and you put it on a greased seasoned tray, you only need to give it a minute under the grill and then leave it to rest. And the residual heat on the tray will just carry on gently cooking that piece of fish so that you have something that's perfectly cooked and it's not dry around the edges.
So you just learned this empirically from working with your product. This is one of the things I think makes this book so valuable, though, because you have all this experience behind these recipes. Give us another Tina's tip.
Oh, I like to, when I grow things like beetroot, for example, I've experimented with lots of different varieties, and there is one variety that's my favorite. It's called Shoggia barbatola.
It's called what?
Shoggia barbatola. And it's a sort of crimson pink, and it's quite sweet to eat. It's very, very attractive. And not only that, it's a crop that utilizes the space it grows in incredibly well. You can grow it a little thicker than most gardeners would normally, and then just select the bigger ones when they're about golf ball size, and that will create space for the smaller seedlings to expand. But the beauty of this particular vegetable is that you can eat it as a vegetable, you can pickle it, you can utilize the leaves of spinach, because the rosé and the golden varieties have far less oxalic acid in the leaves than the deep red varieties, so they're much nicer to eat. So it's quite a, not just a versatile vegetable, it's fairly economic if you're short of growing space.
Now, you include all kinds of wild game and raised game, is it too, in this book?
Probably not raised game, unless you classify pheasant as raised game, which I guess it would be in this country because they raise them for the shoots. And there are many of those around here. And often in the winter, people come knocking on our door with something like 120 birds in the back of their van.
Really?
Looking for a home for them. So.
And you know how you figured out how to cook them?
Well, yes,
them.
We normally oblige and we take them and we prepare them. I have a lovely recipe called, which is bacon wrapped pheasant. And the beauty of that sort of dish is that if you take the breast away from the bone, you can actually look for all the pellets and you can make sure that the dish is completely pellet and bone free. So anybody who's worried about breaking their teeth doesn't have this particular problem.
Now you have a recipe here for Catherine's Sicilian dressing. Now Catherine was your mother.
That's right. Yes.
And she was Sicilian.
She was the eldest of 11 children. My grandfather was Sicilian. He came from Lipari. And he migrated to America and met my grandmother, and they eloped when she was 15 and then started breeding. And my mother was the eldest of 11. So she had to do an awful lot of the cooking for the family of 13. And she was quite well organized, and she passed down my grandmother's secrets, a lot of certainly her passion and her frugality, her resourcefulness, which I think is something that I've picked up on quite a bit throughout the book.
Yeah, and that's what they get with the book too, readers.
Yes,
get
you don't have to be wealthy to cook, you need to be a little bit adventurous and willing to take a few risks and certainly be prepared to experiment.
Now, the overall, you would say perhaps that it's Sicilian inspired, the recipes, but from a strong English base with English ingredients, right?
Well, yes, I think the passion comes from the Sicilian element, and the ingredients obviously are suited to this climate. I'm sure that if I moved to Sicily, then the next book would certainly be a little bit different.
Yes, you have a lot of bread here too.
This is Peter picking up a microphone, because we haven't mentioned yet, but this is a cookbook by an award-winning chef. Tina, let us in on some of the recognition that you've received recently.
Oh, you embarrass me.
Well, I know. I wanted to make sure I put you on the spot.
It's all on our website. It's www.percys.co.uk, and there are a few accolades there, which I'm embarrassed to mention, but we try our best, and it's very nice to get recognised for the effort that we put in to trying to give people a good experience.
Well, I find the recipes really exciting. Breasts of Barbary duck cooked pink with sage and juniper gravy. You even grow your own junipers, don't you?
We do, yes.
You're too much. I don't understand how you found time to write a cookbook.
Neither do I.
You have so many of these recipes. Pick out just a few just to give some idea of what's unique in this book.
Well, obviously, a lot of the pork recipes are utilizing our own produce. And until you try curing your own bacon, there's always a myth as to how difficult it is, but it's not. And to be able to cut a slab of streaky bacon and pop it under the grill and enjoy that for breakfast, knowing that it's home-reared and quite easily cured with your own home cure is lovely. The ice creams are quite nice as well. They're far different.
I remember that from last time. Mm,
yeah. The reason I started to make ice creams when we very first started in London was that there are so many preservatives put into a lot of the commercially made ice creams that they make you quite thirsty. And they're also very much over-sugared, I found. And when you are designing a dessert, say, for example, we have lemon tart and really citrusy lemon tart, and I pair that with a lavender ice cream.
Oh,
so the lemon tart is not too sweet, but it obviously needs enough sugar to balance the lemon juice. And to add a bit of texture, so the creaminess of the lavender ice cream, you don't need to sweeten it too much, because you already have the sweetness in the pastry, the sweet paste and the lemon tart. So when you're making two dishes designed to be eaten together, sometimes you need to adjust the ingredients just a little so that you don't overdo either, in this case, the acid or the sugar.
How about some other favorite recipes?
Again, caramelized apple tart. One of the most famous trees in this country for culinary apple trees is called the Bramley, Bramley seedling. And a few years ago, they had the bicentenary of the development of the Bramley apple. And a lady called Celia Stevens came to us, and she was the great-great-granddaughter of Henry Merriweather, who developed the Bramley into the commercial status it enjoys today. And she donated 12 trees that were grafted from the original rootstock, and there was only one tree that where all these Bramley apple trees stemmed from. And so we are now the proud owners of 12 of these trees. The original tree has since been felled. I'm sad to to say, but so we're very pleased to have these trees. But anyway, on to the caramelized apple tart. The Bramley apple is quite a large apple. It's delicious, but it has quite a good structure of acidity. So that combined with the caramel, the rich caramel of butter and soft brown sugar, go really quite well. So you have the sweetness, and again you have the acidity and the balance of that. And then with the cinnamon ice cream, that we serve with it, we take quite a lot of the sugar out of that so that it's almost a savory ice cream, so that you have the deliciousness of the caramel, the acidity of the apples, and the soft creaminess of the cool ice cream to go with the hot caramel. And that's particularly nice with a glass of your favorite Calvados.
Oh, wow. I haven't had Calvados in years, actually. Well, Tina Bricknell-Webb, remember, readers, or listeners and readers, I hope, from this cookbook, check on our website, and you'll see Percy's cookbook and how you can get it. And it's a lot of lessons. Tina is remarkable. She's, I don't know where she gets her energy. Her talent is very evident. She's a passionate cook, but do you notice how reasonable she is too? Very, very reasonable. So that she's able to teach through this writing of this cookbook. And keep up with Tina's tips. I can hardly wait to learn them myself. Thanks so much, Tina.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, gliding into our final delicious segment.
You can't call these crackers. You really can't call them crackers. I guess you can call them crisp bread.
Crisps.
But what you can actually call them is absolutely delicious. Leslie Stowe from Vancouver, British Columbia, is just a cracker genius.
I fell in love with a product at the Fancy Food Show called Leslie Stowe's Raincoast Crisps. Did I get that, Leslie?
That's absolutely right, Anne.
And you're out of Vancouver?
We're out of Vancouver, Canada, and that's where the name sort of originates. People wonder where the Raincoast part came. Well, we do have, along the west coast from Seattle up to Vancouver, we have a lot of wet weather, and it's pretty temperate climate, but a lot of rain, so that's where the name came. But although people don't seem to always get it.
I got it before I said, isn't that the reason? We just got back from England where it rained every day, too. So.
Oh, yes. Well, very similar client. But they call it rainbow, rainforest, rain, whatever, as long as they buy the product.
Happy. My concern with the name of it, it doesn't really describe your product. Why don't you describe the product for our listeners?
Well, I would say it's a thin, it's almost like a biscotti in that it's actually a double bake, and it's a thin, seedy, chewy,
but it's thin. It's not thick like biscotti. It's thin.
No, it's very thin. But a seedy, grainy, fruity cracker is what it is. And it's fantastic with dips and cheeses. And we have many, you know, five different flavors. And so depending on your preference, there's a flavor for everyone, I believe.
Now let's talk about them.
Now, read your sign, Leslie.
Okay.
How about telling us the names of these flavors?
So we have a fig and olive, figs from California and olives from California. We have a salty date and almond. It just is the newest flavor. And the staff that work with me call it the man cracker because it originated from my husband's persistence in getting us to produce something that had a bit more salt to it, and because salt and snacks sort of go together, and the idea that it's something that, you know, you might have with a glass of beer, or just that that combination, actually, of salt and sweet, because the dates make it sweet, and the salt just gives you that little hit, which is often what people crave when they're wanting some sort of snack. And the original has no fruit in it and no nuts. It's all seeds. And actually, that is my favorite crisp because it goes with so many different things. It goes with seafood as well as meat and as well as cheese. And that was our original crisp. Then we have a cranberry and hazelnut, which is our most popular flavor. And I think it's the sweetness in the cranberries that is appealing to people. And also, cranberry is very popular right now because it's healthy and it's not just associated with things at Christmas. And then the rosemary raisin pecan is another one of my favorites.
To die for. Gorgeous. Oh,
yeah, and it's great with soft cheeses like Santa Gore and Chev and blue cheeses because it's got the sweetness in there and it contrasts nicely with Santagora or Camisola or Gorgonzola, that sort of thing.
Now, you're just not your average common or garden baker of crackers here. Let's make sure our listeners understand that you have a deep culinary background, but then go on to explain where the crackers came from, because I think the story is very interesting.
Well, as my brother would say, I've had like 20-odd years of hard work for overnight success, because I've been in the food business for, well, 25-plus years, and starting with a catering business and wholesale dessert business that evolved into a specialty food store. And it was really through the store and the catering business where you're always having to put one step ahead and trying to be ahead of the crowd and looking for, especially when it comes to hors d'oeuvres, you're always looking for something a little bit different. And so we used to make a Graham bread, which is where the original Raincoast Crisp came from, that we served with smoked salmon. And one day we had some extra and we decided to dry it out in the oven, and that's where the Raincoast Crisp started. And then we really tweaked the original recipe quite a bit, and we were making these at the same time as everything else in the catering sort of world that we were doing for a storefront. We were making these and putting them in small packets, and as soon as they were in the store, they were gone. We ended up having one person just devoted to making them all the time, and we still couldn't keep up with it. So we decided we'd start to try them in a few other stores, and we had people driving miles from all over the place to pick these crisps up because they were just, you know, something a bit different. And, you know, over 85% of households have crackers in their cupboard at all times. And so we thought, well, this is quite different. The whole flatbread sort of phenomena had taken off quite a few years ago, and everyone was making flatbread in every flavor that you can imagine, and which there's lots of great flatbread out there, although it's a much easier product to make than this. So we've taken something that just a bit is unique and also is really tasty and good for you. We didn't promote it originally as like a health product, but it's very healthy for you because it's got flax seeds and sesame seeds, pumpkin seeds, molasses in some of them, honey in some of them, and then the dried fruits and nuts. So it was something that just appealed to a lot of people. And from there, we thought maybe we'd just take a leap of faith and see if we could sell it elsewhere, first in Canada. And we actually moved locations so that we could accommodate this because we were in a very small situation. And from there, we moved to, luckily, close by, to because I say I'm not a risk taker, although many people would dispute that, because to be immodest, I've pioneered lots of things in the food industry locally. But this was just an opportunity to, you know, try something different. I think you have to always be looking ahead in the food industry and reinventing yourself and trying to see how you can venture out in different ways and evolve.
Now, you missed something out at the beginning there, which I thought was rather significant. That you were at a rather well-known Parisian cooking school.
Yes, La Varenne, the Cuisine.
And you also cooked in a Michelin 2-star restaurant in Paris for a short time as well. So
yes, I did.
And which one was it?
Derrière Poquelin, which is near L'Opera. I haven't actually been there for years, so I should check to see if they're still going. But I was the only woman in the kitchen.
I bet they
really pulled your leg and probably hid your knives and did all kinds of things.
Everything. Luckily, I was young and had lots of energy at that time. Not that they don't have those things still, but not to the same degree, I'd say.
Now, you also opened the first, you said that you opened the first gourmet food shop in Vancouver as well.
Previous to our shop, there was really only the European sort of style of deli. And so I saw from traveling in Europe and in the United States and Eastern Canada that there was a real need for something in Vancouver of what I wanted to bring, kind of the specialty food world to Vancouver, in bringing in unpasteurized cheeses and great olive oils and great chocolate, and also having really amazing prepared food. We actually helped the first artisan slow-rise kind of bakery get going. The chef that started up one of the premier sort of artisan bakeries in the city started actually in my kitchen, just making bread on Saturdays.
Oh, that's funny.
Because we couldn't find any good bread to sell, so we pulled him in, and he had spent quite a bit of time in Italy, and it was that sort of style of bread that he did. And he was doing it part-time, and then all of a sudden he was, like, in our kitchen every night. And then it got to the point he actually had to move to his own facility. But we spearheaded a number of things like that in the city. And the whole idea of educating why, you know, someone should buy a $40 bottle of olive oil. We allowed people to taste whatever they wanted in the store and had seminars. We had, I'm not sure if you're, I guess you're familiar with Ari from Zingerman's. He came and did.
Oh, sure.
Oh, Ari.
Sure,
yeah,
absolutely.
We know Ari.
He came and did a cheese seminar for us.
He's
and,
good. He's
yeah,
really good.
And we had a woman that had an amazing olive farm in Tuscany come and do a seminar about olive oil. And so we were really proactive in trying to educate the public and bring things to them that had traveled around, and now people are, we have the opportunity to try different foods like every day, and I think the North American tastes are quite fickle, and you're having Indian food one day and French food the next day, and we have those expectations. But we also now, I think, are looking at the idea of really where is everything coming from, and like trying to get away from like the whole idea of
bringing everything in from everywhere, huh?
Yes, and, well, also the, you know, having things as natural as possible. I think people are much more aware of what they're eating these days and want to eat things that are good for them. And
I'm going to get the chocolate and coffee within a 100-mile radius of where you live.
No. And I mean, I think the local is great to support for produce and meats and things if you can support local, but just the idea of eating, you know, as naturally as possible. And that's what with the Raincoast Crisps, we don't put anything in them. They're totally natural. Like, you read the ingredients, you know what everything is. And I think our job is like, as professionals in the industry, is to help people understand food better, I think, and getting away from, like, the idea of processed food and how we can be better for ourselves. Everyone wants to live forever, and how are we going to do that? But trying to go back to where our grandparents came from, basically the roots of eating better.
Yeah, but they didn't live as long as everybody wants to live.
No,
they worked too hard.
Now, before we forget about Raincoast Crisps, the good news for listeners in our largest audience, which is the United States, is that you have a connection here as well, because we tried Raincoast Crisps at the Fancy Food Show in New York, but the first box we got was given to us by friends who came over for dinner, and they bought it at Whole Foods.
Yes. Well, I have to give Whole Foods a plug in that they were the first retailers to have it in the United States, and they've been extremely great supporters of the product. And now we're venturing out to other retailers so that it'll be available in the store of your preference that sort of will maybe specialize more in sort of the natural and healthy foods.
But you still distribute via the Internet as well?
No, we don't.
No, it's hard to add a Canada into the U.S. I mean,
well, it's just the shipping is too costly.
Oh, right.
And because they're quite fragile, we want people to get them in one piece.
So we
encourage any listener to go on to our website.
That's right. Do you have a store finder on your website?
There is a store finder, which we are constantly updating. And if they can't make a connection there, to just send us an email, and we will direct them to the closest store that they can find them.
Oh, no, that's good. Now, how about the website address?
So it's lesleystowe.com.
Spell it all. LESLEYSTOWE.com. Oh, no kidding.
Singular, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it's not Raincoast Crisps yet?
We have two connections to the site, so lesleystowe.com or raincoastcrisps.com.
Great.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. We're actually going to have to call you one day and pick your brain about where to dine in Vancouver, because we've heard that it's a super place to do just exactly that.
It's a fantastic dining city. We're extremely lucky here, and it's a competitive competitive with the chefs in a very friendly way.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, we're headed that way if we can ever get ourselves organized to go that far from home, and we stock ourselves with raincoats and umbrellas.
Excellent. Well, please contact me.
Leslie. It's been a pleasure meeting you, talking to you, and also getting to know your product, which we adore.
And I'm going downstairs for some raincoats, crisps, and chèvre right now.
Thank you, Anna Peter. It was my pleasure as well.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now.
Well, that does it for another week. I'm glad you could join us. Hope you will join us again next week.
Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.